have a prideful general, a fearful king, an impatient prophet. It's no wonder there seems to be so much confusion in this story. In fact, if it weren't for the outsiders in the story, the enslaved people, I'm not sure that Naaman would ever have been healed. It's a story of reversals. The wisdom of unnamed slaves, the cowardice of a king, the favor shown a foreigner whom God uses for God's purposes, and the simplest cure of all, taking a bath. So to recap the story quickly, Naaman, a powerful Syrian general, one blessed by God with military success, is suffering from a terrible skin disease. None of his wealth or power has been able to find a cure in his country. In one of his army's victories, he captured a young Hebrew girl, and he gave her as a slave to his wife. Despite being enslaved, this girl felt compassion, and she whispered to Naaman's wife that if only Naaman could meet the prophet of God who lived in Samaria, surely he would be healed. So the wife, who was probably tired of Naaman's ranting about his skin, quickly told Naaman, who in his desperation decides to take a chance on this rumor. Now, this is a little odd because high-ranking military officials don't normally take advice from women, let alone young girls, let alone enslaved girls, let alone enslaved girls who were captured from another nation whom he's just defeated in battle. It shows us just how desperate he was. Rather than going straight to Samaria to find this prophet, Naaman just assumed the prophet would be in the employ of the king because, well, that's where the power was, and that was the case in his own experience. So he went to his king and got a letter of introduction, and then he further assumed that he would need to bribe the king of Israel because, after all, Naaman had only just defeated them in battle. So coming back this soon, well, it could have been misinterpreted. So he loaded up a huge baggage train with gifts. When they arrived at the palace in Samaria, the king read the letter and assumed that the other king, the king of Syria, Aram, was looking for a pretext to be angry and therefore justify his further raiding, what we sometimes today call a false flag operation. Remember, this all started because the lowest of the low person in the household said that Naaman should go see a prophet who could cure his disease. And now everyone else's assumptions have brought two countries to the brink of war. Unlike this unnamed slave girl, the king of Israel doesn't seem to know anything about the prophet in his own kingdom. And he tailspins into a panic, thinking that this is somehow a trap, until Elisha makes himself known. King, don't worry, send him on to me. And so Naaman arrives at Elisha's front door with his entire parade of chariots and wagons and wealth and soldiers, assuming this prophet would come out and work some magic. He assumed there'd be fancy rituals with foreign words and hand waving and maybe some special substances. Instead, Elisha doesn't even come out. He stays in the house and sends a messenger to say, "It's all very simple. All you need to do is go into the water of the Jordan River and wash yourself 7 times. Naaman is furious. First, because he thinks it's incredibly rude of Elisha not to come out and greet him. Doesn't he know who I am? And second, because clearly that muddy Jordan River in this pathetic little country can't possibly be better than the rivers in his own country. Naaman craves respect even more than he craves his own health. He's so sure that he knows what is right and fitting, so certain of what should happen, that he almost refuses the gift that God has prepared to give him. Why would he go into an inferior river in an inferior country on the instructions of an inferior prophet that wasn't even in the palace and wouldn't even come out of his hut to speak to the greatest military general in the whole Middle East? He storms off. But once again, unnamed servants save the day, saying, Excuse me, sir. If he had asked you to do something difficult, you would have done it. So why not do the simple thing? And Naaman is persuaded. So because of this, he goes into the water. And it wasn't special water. In fact, it was just a small river compared to the rivers he had at home. And it was muddy and probably a lot less beautiful than those rivers. It was just water. But water that the combination of Elisha's prayer and Naaman's action would set aside from a common to a sacred use. To enter into it, to wash himself 7 times, no less, Naaman had to leave everything else on the shore. He had to leave his baggage train, his wealth, his soldiers and colleagues, his clothes, his ego, and his assumptions on the banks of the river. He had to shed his power and pride to find healing. And then he returned to Elisha's home, where Elisha received him this time, declaring his allegiance to the one true God of Israel. This is a great story. I wonder if there's a word for us today in the midst of this often comedic confusion in Naaman's life. I think there is. You see, sometimes like Naaman, we think God only performs great complicated acts in flashy and dramatic ways. We wait on the big miracle. And that can keep us from seeing how God is at work in the simple tasks and ordinary experiences of everyday life. Our expectations of how things should be can hinder our ability to experience the miraculous, to be grateful for the gifts we are given. And our expectations can also keep us from following God's commandments. If we expect that God sees others as we do, rather than trying to see others as God sees them, it's much easier to feel okay about judging rather than loving, ignoring rather than listening, assuming rather than attempting to know someone better. But just as God works in big and small ways, we are called to be faithful in big and small ways. Compare Naaman's response to that of the enslaved girl. He refused, at least initially, to obey a very simple commandment: go take a bath. As if he was a 2-year-old resisting a parent's best efforts. The enslaved girl, however, was obedient to what Jesus called the greatest commandments, loving God and loving others, even when she was taken from her home and turned into a slave. She was faithful to God and remembered God's words. And even when, in our eyes, she might have been justified in keeping this information about Elijah to herself rather than sharing it with the very one who was responsible for her current state, she told Naaman, the general of the army that had stolen her from her home. You know, it seems only human that she might have enjoyed his suffering just a little, but instead she acted with great faith and compassion. She saw someone hurting and did what she could do to help. She risked a lot to do this because of her faith. If Naaman had made the journey to Samaria and wasn't healed, what do you think the outcome would have been for her? It wouldn't have been good. But she had faith in Elijah, and more importantly, in her God, who Elijah served. And Elijah, too, shows us in a rather ironic way how faithfulness to God doesn't always require the big things we think. He could easily have met Naaman's expectations and received a lot of glory by claiming responsibility for this healing. And instead, he simply pointed Naaman toward God. When we're faithful to God, in big and small ways, in ways that meet our expectations of God, or even when we don't have any idea exactly what God is asking of us, we too point others toward God. Last week, I shared a couple of questions that I hope point us toward doing what God asks of us. Do you remember what they were? What are you already doing? And where can you grow? So this week, I have two more questions for us to ponder, ones that I hope will help us be faithful followers of God. And the first is this: for what are you thankful? I've encouraged this practice before. Keep a list, maybe adding three new things each day. We're called to be thankful, but also this helps us to notice the smaller ways in which God is at work. It's easy to be thankful for kind of the big categories in life, right? But it's the small things, like a warm cup of coffee in the morning, maybe that's a big thing for you, or a jacket to put on when it's cold, or the smile of a neighbor as you pass them on the street, a beautiful sunset, an unexpected text from a friend, a candle that smells like apple pie and makes our home feel welcoming. All of those small things can help us to have faith that God will act in big ways too. If we don't notice the small, it's easy to miss the big. The second question is, how are you responding to God's faithfulness? Another way to think of this is, what are you giving? Now, our giving goes beyond material gifts, although it is sharing from those resources is important. But giving can mean sharing wisdom and knowledge about God, as the enslaved girl did. It can mean giving someone the benefit of the doubt, even if you would rather not. It can mean giving your time to help a neighbor, or taking a moment to share an encouraging word with someone, rather than just thinking it. Anytime that we obey God's commandment to love others, we are giving of ourselves somehow. It can be really easy to get caught up in our own lives, but thinking about giving to others as our response to God's faithfulness can free us from the self-interest and pride that plagued Naaman and often plagues us. When we allow thanks and giving, gratitude and acts of love to be our guide, we, like Naaman, can finally recognize the one true God at work in the world and in our lives. May it be so. You pray with me. God, you are the giver of all good gifts, and sometimes we fail to recognize them because we're looking for something else. Thank you for the blessings that you give us. Help us to have grateful hearts and open eyes to see those gifts. And just as we receive your blessings, God, help us to share those blessings with others, to be people who are known by our love for each other and for the world around us. Help our lives, God, to be full of thanks and giving. We ask this in your name.